It turns out there are other applications for the spent corn used to make whiskey.
Ooh, smells like old beer.
It's a tremendous food source if you're a microbe.
I'm Carol Holzapfel. This week on the Allegheny Front, from distillery waste to fish food to salmon on your plate. And college students take on food waste and their peers in the dining hall.
I mean, like, come on. Like, you take a whole plate and, like, some of it's, like, not even eaten. Like, they eat the chips, but they leave the rest of the sandwich. It's like, just ask for the chips.
Plus, a new podcast takes a personal approach to air pollution.
I don't want to leave because there's so many people that I love here. But I also love to breathe.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. A group of Pennsylvania lawmakers and environmental advocates is trying to lower lead levels in the Commonwealth schools. As WITF's Katie Meyer reports, the problem extends beyond Pennsylvania.
Nationally, there's no requirement that schools be tested for lead at all. In a recent review of 16 states' laws around testing schools' water, advocacy group Penn Environment gave Pennsylvania, and 11 other states, an F. A limited USA Today study also found between 2012 and 2015, water in Commonwealth schools and daycares failed to meet federal residential lead standards at the second highest rate nationally. But a new measure, sponsored by GOP Representative Karen Boback, would require Pennsylvania schools test for lead regularly and install filters or other fixes for any level above 5 parts per billion. That's higher than the EPA's 15 parts per billion standard. Penn Environment's Stephanie Ween says it seems like an obvious move.
There is residential testing done for lead in drinking water. Because there is no federal regulation that forces testing in school drinking water, there's actually this huge gap.
It's unclear how much testing and remediation would cost or where funding could be found. The proposal leaves those details up to the state's Departments of Environmental Protection and Education. Katie Meyer in Harrisburg.
I think it's safe to say podcasts have taken over the world. There is a podcast or a dozen on just about every topic, including the environment, of course. And some of those are produced by environmental groups themselves. The Sierra Club is behind the climate change podcast, No Place Like Home.
And we're going to be exploring this big question. Do our personal choices matter? On one hand, that's the thing that we have the most control over, and on the other hand, we know that our personal individual choices actually don't move the needle on the scale that we need to for our climate.
So a little closer to our home, the Pennsylvania Environmental Council has a podcast, Pennsylvania Legacies.
In this post-truth world we're living in, information that doesn't fit with an individual's worldview can be easily tuned out, obfuscated, or written off as fake news. That makes it harder than ever to get through to people with an environmental message.
And now the Pittsburgh-based Group Against Smog and Pollution has just dropped their first episode of On the Air.
Are we on?
Hello, my name is Emily Prisco, and you are on the air with GASP. GASP, or the Group Against Smog and Pollution, increases awareness and promotes advocacy around southwestern Pennsylvania's poor air quality.
And podcast host and GASP communications and education specialist Emily Persico is here to talk with me about it. Thanks for joining me.
Yeah, of course.
So the first episode of your podcast is called The Nose Knows, and it's about bad smells?
Yeah, it's about foul odors. So basically, the main way that people understand air quality is through odors. You know, they smell them outside, and that's how they kind of come to understand air pollution.
And let's play a short clip from the beginning. This is Pittsburgh resident Lisa Minetti, and she's describing a smell that she's experienced near her home.
It's a sulfurous, acrid, industrial stench. And sometimes it hangs in the air so thick that you feel like you can taste it.
We receive calls all the time from people who are worried about odors and don't really know what to do about them. So a big one that we're kind of concerned with right now is a hydrogen sulfide odor, which smells like rotten eggs. It doesn't sound like that's what Lisa was describing there. They're kind of all sorts of different smells. There's like a whole vocabulary to it. Acrid, industrial, burnt tires, burnt metal. So there's a whole vocabulary there to describe different smells, and some are indicative of specific pollutants and specific toxins, and some of them not so much. So,
Lisa Minetti just moved back to Pittsburgh. She had grown up here.
I don't want to leave because there are so many people that I love here. But I also love to breathe.
Are testimonials from residents going to be part of the podcast?
Yeah, we really hope to make them a big part of the podcast. So we have a microphone that kind of just hooks up to a phone that we're going to take tabling with us. And so hopefully just when we're out in the community doing day-to-day stuff, we can record community members that way. And then we're also encouraging people to call into my voicemail and leave a message. And hopefully we can include that on the show as well.
GASP has been working on these air quality issues really for decades in Pittsburgh. It's one of the oldest environmental groups in the region. Why produce a podcast?
Like you said, we've been doing education in the region for a long time, since 1969. And this is just one other way that we chose to reach people. Kind of the best thing about the podcast platform is that it allows us to explore stories in depth. So our episodes are going to be about 30 minutes long. So we have 30 minutes to explore a single topic, which for us is really important because we really do get into a lot of like behind the scenes, complex, technical, legal stuff. So it's important for us to like have that space to explore these topics through stories that people can connect to and understand. So it's not just about kind of blurting out at a table maybe like 2 minutes worth of information. You know, we're telling stories and we're giving other people the opportunity to tell their stories.
And I don't think I'm giving anything away here. You're a young person. You're younger than I am. I know that you're a lot younger than GASP. So is it a way to sort of reach out to younger population and activists or people who potentially could be activists?
Yeah, for sure. So we do a lot of education with children, mostly like elementary age, middle school age. And then we also do a ton of education with their parents. So there is kind of that gap there, you know, where we're not really reaching those people. And I think podcasts are a really good way to appeal to those kinds of people.
People who aren't little kids and aren't their parents.
Yeah, basically, the whole in-between crew.
You mentioned hydrogen sulfide. I noticed at the end of the podcast, there's kind of a traditional environmental group thing, which is a call to action. Everybody knows what a call to action is. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so that was a really important part of the episode. We want to make sure we include a call to action in every episode because we kind of spend, you know, the first 20 minutes talking about all these problems we have, and we definitely want to focus on there is a solution to these problems. There's something that you can do right now. And we want the call to action to always connect to like the greater episode and to just be something that anyone can do that's pretty easy. So our call to action for this episode for the Nose Nose is the hydrogen sulfide petition. The hydrogen sulfide is a pollutant, a toxin that is emitted in part by coke-making facilities. So definitely over down in Clareton, the Liberty Borough Monitor is one that has recorded countless violations.
That's the Allegheny County Health Department's monitor.
Yeah, that's their monitor. So they've recorded a lot of violations. And then in addition to that, on the Smell Pittsburgh app, which is something that we talk about a little bit more in the podcast, in the last year, there has been over 400 people reporting this rotten egg odor, which is indicative of hydrogen sulfide. So this is a real problem that people are smelling. It's affecting their quality of life, and it's not healthy either. And so the petition basically is to encourage the Allegheny County Health Department, give them a little nudge and say, please follow through with this. Please enforce the law.
The Smell Pittsburgh app is an app on people's phones by Carnegie Mellon University where they can sort of record smells that they smell, and it kind of maps them.
Yeah, so The whole first episode is about how people kind of feel isolated when they're smelling these things, you know, because maybe the person next to them doesn't smell them. Maybe they think they're a little crazy. I've had people tell me that they think they're crazy before because they're smelling things. And the Smell Pittsburgh app really just gives a way for people to report a smell in real time. And then they can see on the app that other people are also smelling the same thing as them. And it, you know, it takes away that isolation.
So the podcast is not all doom and gloom. One of your guests at the end is Shelby Brewster. She's a doctoral student at the University of Pittsburgh. And she came up with a novel idea to taste air pollution by whipping air into egg whites outdoors where there's pollution sources to make meringues. Let's hear a little clip of that.
So just to get this right. So yeah. You were standing outside of the steel foundry and at a bus stop. Literally just whipping up eggs.
Yeah. I stood there with a bowl and a whisk and some egg whites and sugar. And it takes a long time to do it by hand. If you use a stand mixer and plug it in, it's pretty quick. But to do it by hand, it takes, you know, about a half an hour. So I stood there for about a half an hour and whipped up some egg whites.
So Shelby Brewster made these meringues, kind of like candy or cookies, and people ate them?
Yeah, so she actually came to, we had an event last August, I want to say, called the Airfare. And she came to that event. She made all of these meringues for the first time and the only time, actually. And people tried them.
And some people didn't try them.
Some people did not try them, no. Some people were kind of worried. They're like, should I be eating air pollution? You know, and her response was, I mean, you're breathing it. So.
And that's why I think an experience like taste, which is conscious in a way that breathing is not, sort of brings an issue like air pollution, which is so prevalent in Pittsburgh, sort of brings it to the foreground in a different way.
So it's a funny kind of fun experiment and segment, but it brings you back to the topic of this very serious topic of air pollution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is kind of just an easier, lighter way to talk about air pollution that gets people really thinking in a creative and different way.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me.
Yeah, thank you, Kara.
Emily Persico is Communications and Education Specialist at the Group Against Smog and Pollution and the producer of their new podcast, On the Air. There's a link at AlleghenyFront.org. And you might have heard we have our own podcast, Trump on Earth, about all of the changes in environmental policy under the Trump administration. All of those episodes are at TrumpOnEarth.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Kara Holsapple. To help solve environmental problems like air and water pollution, you can volunteer at a cleanup or lobby legislators or start a business.
And the way to do that is to generate an eco-technology which generates an economic incentive to do the right thing environmentally.
Later on the Allegheny Front, an eco-technology that hopes to clean up the environment with our love of bourbon and fish. Stay tuned. About a third of the food in the U.S. is lost or wasted. That's from our refrigerators, from supermarket shelves, and from our institutions. The University of Pittsburgh has been trying to reduce food waste in its dining halls. But how to know if it's working? Volunteers recently put in a whole day at the university's largest dining hall to find out. It serves around 2,500 freshmen each meal, and food is dished out from seven different food stations. The volunteers hung out near the trash cans, donned rubber gloves, and dumped the leftovers from thousands of plates into buckets. Oliver Morrison from Public Source was there too.
My name is Nick Goodfellow. I'm the sustainability coordinator for Sodexo Dining Services at the University of Pittsburgh. When you're also throwing away food, you're throwing away all the resources that went into growing, you know, harvesting, processing, transporting, and preparing that food.
Jared Miller. I'm a freshman.
Yeah, people waste a lot of food here. You know, if you don't think something's that good, then, but you already got it. So, like, you kind of just have to, like, waste it, you know?
I'm Isabel, and we are taking it in, weighing it, seeing how much students waste on campus. It was about 3/4 of a waffle that was still left. So that went right into our buckets. I don't know why you would take that much if you don't want that much.
My chef, Chef Bill, noticed that a lot of plates were being returned with two or three of the menu options not eaten. And so what he decided to do was change the size of the plates pretty quickly. He just decided, let's see if serving food on a smaller plate with smaller portions will impact the amount of food waste we produce. So we haven't measured that yet.
Elizabeth? Oh, DiCaprio.
I'm trying to go fast. All the food keeps piling up. It's like all these people decided to be done at the same time. Like, they planned it.
We're in the full swing of the lunch hour. So it's pretty busy right now. We're trying to... I'll take your cup.
I'm Abigail Nadelson. I took 5 seconds to run out, grab a wrap, and I am now dealing with the food waste with my left hand and eating the wrap with my right hand. I'm going to dump it into the food waste bin. Oh! Can I eat this? There's so much here. There's so much mac and cheese that has been wasted.
I mean, like, come on. Like, you take a whole plate and, like, some of it's, like, not even eaten. Like, they eat the chips, but they leave the rest of the sandwich. It's like, just ask for the chips.
I don't even know what time it is right now. I'm just trying to get through the lunch rush. I think it's probably about 2-ish.
Hilton Braithwaite, the fourth. Maybe a little bit of rice and some corn that I had in there, but no leftovers in terms of the main stuff.
A donut and some of that waffle. Nah, I'm finished with it. Because I just didn't feel like eating it.
I ate the chicken and I left the rice because it was like pretty hard.
I'd look at it and be like, oh, it's just like a little bit left. Like it's not, you know what I mean? Like I wouldn't think it's that much, but as a food waste auditor, I look at it and I'm like, oh, that's like, all that food is just being dumped right into the trash can. Like it's such a waste, you know?
We've collected about 270 pounds of food waste and about more than half of that was just in the last 2 hours alone. So I think the menu is steak and lobster. I really hope that we don't see any steak and lobster thrown out. That would be crushing. That would be horrible.
A lot of steak, a lot of polenta.
A lot of chicken, steak, absolutely.
A lot of steak, like full steaks too. Like, I'm Larissa, and that's Chelsea and Mara.
I'm Chelsea.
So we're at the final stretch of the day. It's midnight. We started at 7 a.m. and 810 pounds later, I'm very tired.
After comparing the food waste data to the number of people who attended Market Central, we saw a 5% reduction in per person food waste compared to our food waste audits the year before.
Ouch, whole steaks. Well, there's a lot more by public sources Oliver Morrison on efforts to reduce food waste in our region. That's at AlleghenyFront.org. The story is part of a collaboration between Public Source and 90.5 WESA, exploring food access in the Pittsburgh region. Later, we'll hear more about a novel way to divert the waste from breweries and distilleries. I'll give you a hint, it's still fish fry season. That's coming up on the Allegheny Front.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Center for Environmental Research and Education at Duquesne University, now celebrating 25 years of preparing environmental professionals. The center provides multidisciplinary education for careers in environmental science and management with opportunities for research and internships. Programs include a BS in Environmental Science, Master's in Environmental Science and Management, and professional certificate programs. More information on the Center for Environmental Research and Education can be found at duq.edu/ESM.
We've had some pretty typical late winter weather in our region. Cold, wet, snow. But like last year, and continuing a trend, spring is coming early to much of the West Coast, South, and Mid-Atlantic this year, up to 2 or 3 weeks early, according to scientists. That's where Dan Herms comes in. He was formerly a researcher at Ohio State University who looked at how insects interact with plants, like in orchards or ornamental gardens, and how weather and climate affect and sometimes disrupt plants and insect cycles. So on the cusp of the vernal equinox, we thought we'd revisit this interview with Dan Herms.
A lot of times we don't or can't connect the dots with weather and then, of course, the larger picture of climate. But you do study the cycles and the seasonal nature of plants and animals, insects, you're an entomologist, and climate. So, and that's called phenology. So first, can you explain the concept of phenology? Kind of give us a phenology 101.
Sure. Phenology is the study of reoccurring biological events, like when things flower, migration times of animals, breeding times, when insects emerge, these kind of things that occur on a regular basis from one year to the next. It's been called the oldest science because the existence of humans, of course, is very tightly linked to phenology, planting season, birthing season of animals.
I was going to say, this is nothing new, and we were thinking about the Old Farmer's Almanac, but it goes back a lot further than that.
Goes back eons.
In your research, you use it as a predictor for when certain insects may be visiting our area.
The development time of insects is completely dependent on the temperature, and so they develop faster in warm springs and summers and slower in cool springs. And so insects are basically a mobile weather station. And if you track the weather, you can predict very accurately when certain insects will appear or when plants will bloom.
So could you give me an example of an insect plant phenology from our region?
One of my favorite plants for monitoring phenology is a native shrub or small tree that's in the forest called the serviceberry. Serviceberry blooms around here in mid-April, and they call it serviceberry because the timing of its blooming corresponded when the pioneers would have funeral services for people that died during the winter, because the ground was now thawed enough to bury the people that had passed away during the winter. It's also called Juneberry because the flowers develop in June, and it's also called shadbush because at the time that the flowers bloom, the shad run up the streams from the Great Lakes to spawn.
So it's got a lot of connections with a lot of phenomena that are happening at the same time that are weather-related.
Right. It certainly does.
How can a change in climate or global warming, a warming climate, what are some of the ways it can affect plant and insect phenology?
Well, as the climate warms and as the spring warms, plants and insects develop faster and emerge sooner. So that's one thing. And as an example, we have a spectacular crabapple display here on campus. And it was always said that come on Mother's Day weekend, if you want to see the crabapples bloom. Well, now the crabapples generally bloom a couple weeks before Mother's Day. And we tell people to come the last week of April if you want to see those bloom. Another change is in the distribution of insects. And so as the temperatures get warmer, insects that formerly could not survive in a particular area because it was too cold are moving into that area.
I wanted to know if there were other implications for climate change and phenology. I understand that phenology is sort of chronological in that the order doesn't necessarily change. For example, the tree flowers and the insect shows up so many, you know, days later. Does climate change have any impact on that chronological cycle?
There has been documented what we call phenological asynchrony. And one example could be bird migrations. So as the birds come back in the wintertime, they're not responding to the climate here. They're responding to cues on their overwintering ground. And when they get here, they can find that the insects that they're used to feeding on have already completed development, for example. And in some Arctic birds, it's already been shown that their breeding has been disrupted because of this kind of phenological mismatch between their migration time and the abundance of their food.
What is the maybe since you've been looking at this so long, you've been looking at the data so long, what is the biggest change that you've seen?
You know, just kind of this general change of how, you know, much earlier things are blooming in Michigan, not only in my data, but also, you know, when we rake the leaves. You know, it used to be by Halloween, all the leaves were down. Now Thanksgiving and the oak leaves still aren't down. So the change has been pretty dramatic if you pay attention.
And this is something that worries you.
It does, because, you know, the thing is that organisms and humans tend to be adapted to the climate that they have experienced over the long term. And, you know, when that changes, it's going to require that organisms, including us humans, adapt to the new reality, and we're going to have to.
Thank you so much for talking to me. I really appreciate it.
No, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Dan Herms is an entomologist, formerly with Ohio State University. Now he's vice president for research and development at Davy Tree Expert Company. You can learn more about the intersection of weather and climate at AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. Two companies in the Great Lakes region are teaming up for an unusual experiment in sustainability. They're starting an aquaculture business, and a key element is the waste left over from producing whiskey. Great Lakes Today's Angelica Morrison has more.
I'm out on farmland in western New York near the shore of Lake Erie. It's where you'll find 5 and 20 Spirits and Brewing. There's a large white barn set back behind the brewery. Turns out they make more than just booze here. They raise fish. Jerry Northrup takes me inside. He's the founder of Timberfish Technologies, and he wants to show me his life's work, a land-based aquaculture system. As the door opens, the sound of water bubbling in concrete tanks bounces off the curved walls and ceiling.
There it is.
Oh, it's like a big tent. Woo! It smells like old beer.
That's the stillage that came in. I just pumped some stillage. They've been fermenting corn, and they're going to make bourbon out of that.
The stillage flows from a pipe into a steel bin. It has the color and texture of watery, chunky peanut butter.
So you can see it's pretty gookie-looking stuff. But it actually is, it's a tremendous food source if you're a microbe.
And it's the first step in a food chain. Air flows throughout the system, allowing microbes to break down and eat the stillage. The microbes are fed to invertebrates like earthworms, snails, and insect larvae, and then the fish get to feast on them. Now, the goal is to raise several types of fish and then sell them commercially.
Instead of discharging a waste stream into the environment, where it can cause water pollution and odor and all of those kinds of things, we turn that into a saleable product.
Northrup says the technology, backed by a state grant, has a larger purpose, too.
And this is back to how we resolve the major environmental problems, which are due to a rising population, increasing pollution of the environment. And the way to do that is to generate an ecotechnology which generates an economic incentive to do the right thing environmentally.
And it makes financial sense for the brewery. It cuts waste disposal costs by thousands every year. Mario Maza is the brewery's general manager. Adding the fish farm helps take the family business one step further.
We've been in business here in the community for a number of years now, and we feel it's a good way to give back to the community and try to do something that's responsible. And it's a fun project. It's just cool to watch it come together from what was just a concept on paper a few years ago.
Now, aquaculture facilities are typically set up in oceans or lakes, but the concept of a land-based system raising fish in tanks is slowly catching on. It could be a good fit for the Great Lakes region, says Kevin Madley. He's the regional aquaculture coordinator for NOAA Fisheries, a federal agency.
So the Great Lakes themselves, the states have so far used a precautionary approach to putting aquaculture fish pens in the Great Lakes. They feel like there's a chance for environmental harm, and therefore they're being very cautious in doing background research.
The brewery has the capacity to produce about 20,000 pounds of fish every year. They're raising three different species, the speckled trout, Arctic char, and Atlantic salmon.
The fish have an excellent nutrient composition. So they have a natural taste and color because they're eating their natural foods. They're
right.
Not eating a pellet food so much.
No mercury and shenanigans.
No mercury and none of that sort of stuff.
How about that?
We control all of the inputs, so since there's no toxic elements in the inputs, there won't be any toxic elements in the fish.
The fish will be plate ready in the summer of 2019. For Great Lakes Today, this is Angelica Morrison.
Great Lakes Today is a collaboration of WBFO Buffalo, IdeaStream Cleveland, and WXXI Rochester. Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Allegheny Front. Kathy Nauer is the executive producer of our show. I'm Carol Holzapfel.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Catherine Mavis McKenna Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation.